chief fabricator. On the screen, Shyama Sen arched his eyebrows and jerked his head back in a fine display of innocence. We're testing the weapon you ordered from us, Mother Commander. You asked for a demonstration rather than taking us at our word. We must prove that our technology functions as advertised. And the rivalry between Ix and Richesi had nothing to do with your choice of targets? She barely held her sarcasm in check. Richesi is just a historical footnote, Mother Commander. Any enjoyment Ixians might have taken from our rival's unfortunate fate has long since faded. After a pause, Sen added, We admit, however, that the irony does not escape us. Since last visiting her high above Chapter House, the factory leader sounded subtly changed. Recently, when Sen had come back to deliver full records of all their tests on Ix, he had seemed surprised, even embarrassed. He had followed her suspicious suggestion and used the cellular test on all of his people, with the result that 22 face dancers had been exposed, all of them working in critical industries. Mirbella would have liked to interrogate them, maybe even apply an Ixian T-probe. But those face dancers who weren't immediately killed took their own lives, somehow using a machine-like suicide shutdown in their own brains. The lost opportunity angered her, but she doubted her sisters would have learned anything from the shapeshifters anyway. Nevertheless, she was glad to have installed 8 trusted inspectors to watch over the industrial progress from that point onward. Our delivery schedule is tight, Mother Commander, as you demanded, Sen transmitted. We are arming the ships from Junction as quickly as possible. After seeing these 4 obliterators successfully tested, you can't deny that our technology is reliable. It seems a shame to waste such destructive power on a target that doesn't harm the true enemy, Janess said. But we require proof. Both of them had reviewed earlier films of the tests, but those could have been faked. I still want to see it with my own eyes, Mirbella said. Then we'll throw everything into a defense against the machine advance. Deploying the nodes now, transmitted one of the Ixian pilots. Please observe. 4 balls of light spat from the quartet of Ixian ships, and the incandescent obliterators spun like pinwheels toward the cracked world below. They shuddered and expanded as they descended, throwing off rippling waves that grew brighter instead of dampening. The atmosphere of Richesi had already been scorched, its forests and cities leveled in the first chain reaction. Even so, the Ixian modified weapons found sufficient fuel to set the world ablaze all over again. Mirbella remained silent as she watched the awesome swiftness of the flame fronts. She stared without blinking until her eyes felt dry. The planet flared like an ember in a breeze. Cracks appeared across the continents. Orange rifts blazed up. Finally, she spoke to her daughter, not caring that the Ixians could overhear on the open comm line. If we deploy such a weapon in the midst of a thinking machine battle fleet, it will wreak inconceivable havoc. We might actually have a chance, Janess said. Shyama Sen interrupted through the speakers. You assume, Mother Commander, that the thinking machines will be foolish enough to fly their ships in such a tight cluster that one weapon will suffice. We know a great deal about the enemy's battle plan and how their fleet has been advancing. They do not use fold space engines, so they move methodically from one target to the next, step by step. With the thinking machines, there are few surprises. Mirbella looked at her daughter, then back at the burning planet before snapping orders to the Ixians. Very well. No need to squander any more obliterators. When we finally hurl them at machine battleships, that will be demonstration enough for me. I want at least 10 obliterators aboard each of our new warships. No more delays. We have waited too long already. It will be done, Mother Commander, Sen said. Mirbella chewed at her lower lip as she watched Richesi continue to blaze. It wasn't like the chief fabricator to be so cooperative, failing to demand additional payment. Perhaps, after seeing countless worlds already destroyed, the Ixians had at last recognized their true enemy. Whether we see them or not, there are nets everywhere, encompassing our individual and collective lives. Sometimes it is necessary to ignore them for the sake of our own sanity. Ship's log, Duncan, Idaho entry. Face dancers aboard. In her quarters with little Aaliyah and 12-year-old Leto, Jessica felt very much like a mother again. After all these centuries, the three of them had a shared past and bloodline, but no other knowledge or memories in common. Not yet. To Jessica, it seemed that they were little more than actors, memorizing lines and playing roles, trying to be who they were supposed to be. Her body was only 17, but she felt much older as she comforted the two younger ones. What is a face dancer? 3-year-old Aaliyah asked, toying with a sharp knife she kept at her side. Since the time she could walk, the girl had harbored a fascination for weapons, and she often sought permission to practice with them rather than playing with more appropriate toys. Are they coming to get us? They're already in the ship, Leto said, still shaken. He could not believe that Thufir had been a face dancer and that he hadn't known it. That's why we were all tested. No others have been found yet, Jessica said. She and Thufir had been decanted in the same year. In the creche, she had been raised with the gola of the warrior Mentat, and never had she noticed any change in his personality. It did not seem possible that Thufir could have been a face dancer from the very beginning. The real Hawat, master of assassins and former weapons master of House Atreides, had been a veteran of numerous successful campaigns like Bashar Miles Teg, serving 3 generations of House Atreides. No wonder Shiana and the Bene Gesserits had considered him an invaluable ally. That was why they had wanted to bring him back, and now it was obvious why their memory-triggering crisis hadn't worked. Thufir was not really Thufir, and perhaps never had been. Now, unless clean cells were found to grow a new gola, the people aboard the Ithaca would never have access to Hawat's mentat and tactical skills. In fact, Jessica realized that after all this time, the Gola Project had produced very little that could be used to help them. Only Yui, Stilgar, and Liet Kynes had been reawakened to their past lives, but the latter two were gone. And Yui, while a skilled Sook doctor, was not a particularly great asset to their team. He killed my Duke Leto. Again. With the face dancer threat, the missing explosive mines, and the various incidents of sabotage, the need for the Golas and their old skills had become more urgent. The remaining unawakened Gola children must have special abilities. Jessica knew they had all been brought back for a reason. Each of them. Paul, Chaney, and she were all of an appropriate age. Even Leto II should be old enough. Gradual, careful measures could not possibly be sufficient. Not anymore. She sighed. If not now, then when would their historical abilities be useful? I must have my memories back. Jessica could offer so much more to benefit the no-ship, if given the opportunity. She felt like a husk of a person without her original life. In her quarters, she stood up so swiftly that she startled both Aaliyah and Leto. You two should return to your rooms. Her gruff voice invited no argument. There's something important I have to do. These Bene Gesserits are cowards, though they don't realize it. They can no longer afford to be. In some ways, Shiana was brash and impetuous, but in other ways overly cautious. Jessica knew someone, however, who would not shy away from inflicting pain upon her. Who are you going to see? Leto asked. Garimi. The hard-line Reverend Mother regarded her with a stony expression, then smiled slowly. Why should I do this? Are you mad? Just pragmatic. Do you have any understanding of how much this is going to hurt? I am prepared for it. She looked at Garimi's dark, curly hair, her flat and unattractive features. Jessica, by contrast, was the very ideal of classical beauty, designed by the Bene Gesserit to play the role of a seductress, a breeding mother whose features had been copied again and again for centuries after her death. And I know, Proctor Superior, that if anyone can inflict that pain, you are prepared to do so. Garimi seemed caught between amusement and uneasiness. I have imagined countless ways to twist the knife in you, Jessica. I have often considered how much harm your actions did to the old sisterhood. You derailed our entire Kwisatz Haderach program, created a monster we couldn't control. After Paul, as a direct consequence of your defiance, we suffered thousands of years under the tyrant. For what conceivable reason would I want to awaken you? You betrayed us. So you say. Garimi's words struck like hurled stones. The woman had tormented Jessica for years, as well as poor Leto II. Jessica knew all the accusations, understood how the conservative Bene Gesserit faction viewed her. But she had not previously endured the shocking depth of hatred and anger that the woman now showed toward her. Your own words reveal a great deal, Garimi. The old sisterhood. Where are your thoughts? We are already living in the future. That doesn't negate the terrible pain you caused. You keep insisting that I should bear that guilt. But how can I feel it if I don't remember? Are you content with me as a scapegoat, a whipping boy for all the imagined wrongs of the past? Shiana wants my memories restored so that I can help us. But you, Garimi, should be just as eager to awaken me. Admit it. Can you think of a better Bene Gesserit punishment than drowning me in the unforgivable things you say I've done to the sisterhood? Awaken me. Make me see it for myself. Garimi reached out and grabbed her wrist. Instinctively, Jessica tried to pull away, but was unsuccessful. The other woman's expression hardened. I am going to share with you. I'm going to give you all my thoughts and memories so that you'll know. Garimi leaned closer. I will dump into your brain those hundreds of generations of past lives that occurred after you committed your crime so that you can see the full scope and consequences of what you did. She pulled Jessica up against her.
That's not possible.
Only Reverend Mothers can share. Jessica tried to scramble backward. Garimi's eyes were steely. And you are a Reverend Mother. Or you were. Therefore, one lives within you. She clasped the back of Jessica's head, grabbed her bronze hair, and yanked her closer. Garimi leaned her own forehead down and pressed it against Jessica's. I can make this work. I'm strong enough. Can you imagine why I'm doing it? Perhaps the grief will be enough to paralyze you. Jessica fought back. Or it will make me stronger. She'd wanted her own memories, yes, but had never offered to accept all of Garimi's experiences, or those numerous ancestors who had lived through the persecutions of the God Emperor of Dune, her own grandson. All those who had survived the famine times, struggling to overcome their addiction to melange, which was no longer available. The horrors of those generations had left deep scars on the human psyche. Jessica did not want that at all. Garimi insists that I caused it. She felt something inside her head and resisted, but Garimi was stronger, forcing the sharing upon her, pouring memories, unleashing them. Hammers pounded Jessica's skull from the inside, strong enough to crack through bone and break out. She heard a snapping sound in the blackness and wondered if Garimi had won. Shaken, Jessica, the real Jessica, bound concubine to Duke Leto Atreides, reverend mother of the Bene Gesserit, looked around herself with a new wonder she had never imagined possible. Though she saw only the walls of the no-ship, she recalled how good her life had been with the Duke and with their son Paul. She remembered the shell-blue sky of Caladan, the spectacular sunrises on Arrakis. In the end, she had beaten Garimi. Now she marched out of the angry woman's quarters, swaying and saturated with the knowledge. That flood of memories was a mixed blessing and a new burden, for she was without her beloved Duke Leto. The sudden emptiness made her feel as if she were plunging into an endless pit. Leto. My Leto. Why couldn't the sisters have brought you back at the same time, like Paul and Chaney? And damn you, Yui, for taking him from me twice. She felt profoundly alone, her heart drained and her mind left with mere memories and knowledge. Jessica was determined to find a way to make herself useful to her sisters once more. Returning to her quarters, she found Aaliyah waiting for her. Possessing a sharp intelligence far beyond her years, the girl looked her over calmly and said, Mother, I told Dr. Yui you would have your memories back. Now he's even more afraid of you. You could kill him with a look. I chased him and kicked him for you. Jessica fought back her automatic hatred of Yui, the old Yui. You mustn't do that. Especially not now. The traitor had been right to fear the return of her memories, even though she had already known of his crimes and forgiven him. But that was with my head, not with my heart. As she stood there, Jessica's restored memories and emotions drove the dagger in deeper. With a rush of emotion, she found herself unable to keep from reaching out and hugging Aaliyah fiercely. Then she looked upon her daughter for the very first time. I am your mother again. A test must be defined before it can be useful. What are the parameters? What is the accuracy? Too often a test does nothing more than analyze the tester herself. Bene Gesserit Handbook. The death of the Hawat face dancer couldn't be kept secret for long. Everyone was accounted for and locked away while Shiana and her cadre of tested individuals performed a full count, isolated and approved security teams, and then guided all of the ship's inhabitants into the main meeting hall. That giant chamber could easily house hundreds of people for days if need be, and if enough food was brought in. Meanwhile, Garimi remained up on the navigation deck, monitoring the Ithaca by herself. Since all hands, at least the known ones, were sealed in the meeting hall, any hidden traitors could very well be trapped inside. In the next few days, over the course of meticulous testing, any remaining face dancers among them would be rooted out. At first, the younger children born during the journey seemed to think it was a game, but they soon grew restless. The people became uncomfortable and suspicious, wondering why only a handful of individuals were allowed to come and go on mysterious assignments. And why was the horrid little Tliloxu one of the trusted ones? Many of those aboard still viewed Cytale with open scorn, but he was accustomed to such treatment. The Tliloxu race had always been despised and distrusted. Now who was to blame? Working frantically over the past day, he and the Sook doctors had assembled enough analytical kits to perform a genetic comparison on every untested individual. As a backup plan, he had also created enough of his face dancer-specific toxic gas to fill numerous canisters, though Shiana was not ready to approve such a hazardous experiment. Not yet. They didn't trust him enough and kept the gas under their strict control. He didn't trust them entirely either. After all, he was a Tliloxu master, perhaps the last one in existence. Secretly, he put together a more startling fail-safe test, knowing full well what he was doing. He told no one of it. When all was ready, Cytale sat in a front row for what he expected to be an important process of revelation. He watched the uneasy Bene Gesserits, Sook doctors, archivists, and proctors. Out in the audience, Teg sat next to the rabbi and two Bene Gesserit sisters. The Gola children were a few rows away, each of them already proven to be untainted. Duncan Idaho waited by one of the sealed doors, and male Bene Gesserits guarded the other exit points. While the gathered passengers waited, Shiana spoke from the front of the meeting chamber, her words clear and uncompromising with an edge of voice. We have discovered a face dancer among us, and we believe there are more in this room. A moment of shocked silence extended uneasily as she attempted to make eye contact with every individual. Cytale was not surprised that no one stepped forward. The old rabbi looked simultaneously indignant and lost without the rest of his people. From the seat next to the old man, Teg told him to be patient. The rabbi glared, but did not argue. We have created a foolproof test. Shiana sounded weary, even though her voice boomed. It will be tedious and time-consuming. But you will all submit to it. I hope none of you has anything better to do. Duncan crossed his arms over his chest and flashed a grim smile. The doors will remain guarded until this process is complete. Cytale and the Sook doctors came forward to the stage, carrying kits, syringes, and chemical swabs. As each one of you is cleared, our ranks of reliable allies will grow. No face dancer can elude this scrutiny. Who was this face dancer you caught? One of the sisters asked, an undertone of anxiety in her voice. And why do you assume there are others among us? What is your evidence? When Shiana explained how the worms had killed Thufir Hawat, stunned murmurs rippled through the audience. The Bashar called from his seat with an edge of guilt and revulsion in his tone. We know that the false Thufir could not have been responsible for all the sabotage incidents we have on record. He was with me in person when several of the known incidents occurred. How do I know you're not all face dancers? The rabbi rose to his feet and glared at Shiana, the souk doctors, and especially Saitel. Your behavior has never been comprehensible to me. Teg tugged him back down. Shiana ignored the old man's question and pointed to the front row. I will take the first subject now. Two female souk doctors moved forward with their kits, and Shiana said, Make yourselves comfortable. This will take a while. For Saitel, though, this process was primarily a diversion, and even the Bene Gesserits didn't know it. Feeling trapped, any face dancer in the audience would be trying to find a way to escape detection. Therefore, the Tliloxu master had to act precipitously, before any hidden shapeshifters could make a move. Watching the large audience closely, he fingered the small device he carried. While the slow, analytical procedure was certainly reliable, Saitel had fashioned his secret plan based on what he knew of the old face dancers created by the original Tliloxu masters. He was betting that the new shapeshifters from the scattering were similar, at least in their fundamental responses. They must have emerged from the same basic blueprint. If so, he might know how to expose them, a weak and secondary test. But its very unexpectedness might work in his favor. In the center of the meeting chamber, the souk doctors performed their first test on a submissive sister. She extended her hand, waiting for a drop of blood to be drawn. Without warning, Saitel activated his high-pitched whistle emitter. A shrill tone warbled up and down, intense but faint, above the range of most human hearing. The original face dancers had once communicated with the Tliloxu in a coded whistling language, a secret set of programming notes burned into their neurological structures. Saitel believed the irresistible noise would make any face dancer lose his disguise, at least temporarily. Suddenly, out in the tiers of seats, the old rabbi flickered and his body convulsed. His leathery face shifted and smoothed behind his beard. He let out a cry of surprised outrage and lunged to his feet. Now the old man was unexpectedly supple, wiry, and vicious. His face was flat with sunken eyes and a pug nose like a bare skull made of half-melted wax. "Face dancer!" someone shouted. The rabbi became a whirlwind and threw himself against the Bene Gesserits. Never underestimate your enemy or your allies. Miles Teg, Memoirs of an Old Commander. Due to his constant complaints, negative attitude, and frail appearance, everyone aboard had dismissed or misjudged the old rabbi, as had Miles Teg. In moves as swift and deadly as a laser beam, the face dancer slammed the Bashar with a blow that would have shattered his skull if it had struck squarely. Just in time, Teg recoiled with a flash of inhuman speed. It was enough to save his life, but even so, the attack stunned him. Abruptly, the rabbi killed two sisters on the other side of him, then moved in a direct, murderous line toward the nearest exit, clearing the way with a flurry of deadly blows. From hidden pockets in his dark, conservative clothes, the face dancer withdrew a small throwing dagger for each hand. The blades were no longer than his thumbs, but he hurled them with precision. The sharp tips, undoubtedly poisoned, pierced the throats of two male Bene Gesserits who guarded the door. With barely a sound, the rabbi shoved their dying bodies out of the way and plunged out into the corridor. Saitel urgently scanned the crowd to make certain that this one escaping enemy did not divert attention from any other face dancers hidden among those gathered in the chamber. The Tliloxu saw no other sudden shiftings. Shiana shouted for others to pursue the rabbi. We know who he is, but he can change his shape. Now we have to track him down. One of the sisters tried to use the ship's intercom to warn Garimi, but got no response. It's been damaged. Fix it. Shiana realized that the rabbi had had sufficient time during their quarantine in this large chamber to subtly perform more sabotage. Dr. Yui rushed to a groaning Teg and bent to check the severity of his injury. Beside him, the two fallen sisters were obviously dead. The look on the Gola doctor's face was of dismay rather than vindication. As he examined Teg, he murmured, as if trying to make sense of the situation. The rabbi gave me the sample of the Gola baby's cells. He must have taken Piter DeVries's cells from storage and tricked me. He knew what I would do, how I would react. Duncan glanced from Yui and Teg to Shiana. The connection is obvious to me now. Thufir Hawat and the rabbi. Why didn't I see it? Shiana caught her breath as she suddenly realized the same thing. Both went down to the planet of the Handlers. Duncan nodded. Hawat and the rabbi were alone together during the hunt of the honored Matres. You all had to fight your way back to the lighter after you discovered that the Handlers were face dancers.
Of course.
Shiana's face was grave. Those two came running in from the forest at the last moment. It seems they didn't escape the Handlers after all. So the original rabbi and Thufir, Duncan began, both dead long ago, replaced by face dancers on the planet and their bodies discarded during the hunt. Finally achieving Mentat focus, Duncan jumped to the next obvious conclusion. Then it's been more than 5 years since the substitutions. 5 years? In all that time, the Hawat and Rabbi duplicates must have been waiting for their opportunity, killing Golas and Axolotl tanks, sabotaging our life support systems, forcing us to stop at Kelso where we were vulnerable to discovery by our pursuers. Did the enemy pick up our trail there? So far we've managed to elude the net, but now that the face dancers have been exposed... Shiana paled.
And what about the stolen mines?
What did the rabbi do with the explosive mines? He can set them off at any time if he gets to them. Starting to recover, but clearly woozy, Teg was already moving toward the door. That face dancer knows he has to seize the no-ship before we can kill him. He will head for the navigation bridge.
Garimi is there, Shiana said.
Let's hope she can stop him. By the time the face dancer reached the navigation bridge, he had resumed his disguise as the rabbi. He contained all the memories, experiences, and personality details of the old man, and much more. The frail and frightened-looking rabbi burst into the chamber, startling Garimi.
What are you doing up here? She asked.
His eyes were wide and panicked as if he thought she could offer him protection. His spectacles had fallen off.
Face dancer, he panted, staggering toward her.
He's killing Bene Gesserits. Garimi spun toward the intercom panel to contact Shiana, and the rabbi struck. His deadly blow came close to her neck, but she sensed the movement and turned at the last possible moment. The side of his fist drove down on her shoulder instead. She slid from her chair, and the rabbi dove at her again. Garimi launched a kick up at him from the deck, aiming for one of the old man's knobby and uncertain knees, but he sprang away like a coiled panther. The rabbi let out a feral yowl as Garimi leapt to her feet again and assumed a defensive stance. Her lower lip curled.
Clever, rabbi. Even now that I know what you are, I can hardly smell any face dancer stink on you.
With a yank and a twist, the rabbi uprooted an anchored chair and swung it at her. She ducked and reached up to grab the chair as it whistled over her head. Tearing it out of his hands, her pull was enough to knock him to the floor. When the rabbi rose to his feet again, he shifted his body to mimic the form of a ferocious futhar. His body bulged with muscles, his teeth became sharp and elongated, and his claws slashed the air. Garimi stumbled back to get out of his killing reach and hammered her hand down on the intercom.
"Sisters! Face dancer on the navigation bridge!"
The futhar lunged, and his sharp, newly grown claws ripped her robes. Using wild and frantic punches intended more to hurt her foe than protect her own life, Garimi shattered his ribs. With an outraged kick that employed the full force of her heel, she smashed his left femur out of its hip socket. But the futhar rolled as he collapsed, spun in a blur, and before she could feel a moment of victory, he snapped Garimi's neck. She dropped with barely a sigh. In a purely spiteful gesture, he ripped out her throat before calmly reshaping his body to his blank face dancer state. He wiped blood from his face with one sleeve. More broken than even his own shapeshifter abilities could easily heal, the rabbi crawled and then limped to the Ithaca's main controls. He heard running feet in the corridor, so he sealed the navigation bridge, applied emergency locks, and activated a mutiny defense protocol. In the years he had maintained his disguise, the face dancer had covertly sampled the skin cells of Duncan Idaho, Shiana, and Bashar Miles Tegg. Now his hands flowed into the proper identification prints so that the no-ship's highly secure controls responded to him. The sealed doors would stand against any intrusion. Eventually, the Bene Gesserits would find a way to break in, but by that time he would have completed his mission. His thinking machine masters would be alerted, and they would come. Long ago, he had studied how to operate the Holtzman engines, estimating the coordinates as best he could, not worried about the lack of a navigator. The face dancer folded space and plunged the Ithaca across the galaxy. The ship tumbled out into a different stellar region, not far from Omnius's advancing forces. He reconfigured the ship's comm systems and triggered a locator beacon. His superiors knew the signal. The thinking machines would respond swiftly. Already the face dancer could sense the hungry, invisible tachyon net coming closer. This time there would be no escape. The no-ship would be completely trapped. Even small opponents can be deadly. Bene Gesserit, Analytical Report on the Tleilaxu Problem. By the time Duncan, Shiana, and Tegg reached the navigation bridge, the thick hatches were sealed and locked. Impregnable. The bridge had been designed to remain secure against even an army. Within moments, other sisters followed, having first raced to the armory and obtained hand weapons. Poisonous needle guns, stunners, and a high-powered laser cutter. None of those devices would be sufficient. Rushing forward, the Gola children joined the crowd outside the sealed bridge, among them Paul, Cheney, Jessica, Leto II, and young Aaliyah. Duncan could feel the change when the no-ship lurched through fold space.
"He's at the controls, moving us!"
"Garimi is dead, then,"
Shiana concluded.
"The face dancer is going to take us directly to the enemy," Tegg said.
"Now is the time to use Cytale's poison gas to kill the face dancer."
Shiana turned to two of the sisters standing in the corridor.
"Find the Tleilaxu and take him to our guarded cabinet. Get one of the canisters, and we will flood the air on the bridge with the gas."
"No time for that," Duncan said. "We've got to get in there."
Aaliyah sounded eerily cool and intelligent as she announced,
"I can get inside."
Duncan looked at the girl. To him, The echo memories evoked by this child were unsettling. The original Duncan had never known her as a youngster. He had been killed by Sardaukar while Jessica was barely pregnant. But he did have vivid memories of an older Aaliyah as his lover in another life. But that was all history. Now it might as well be myth or legend. He bent down to talk to her. How? There isn't much time.
I'm small enough.
With a flick of her eyes, the little girl indicated the narrow air exchanger vents leading into the command deck. She was far more diminutive than even Cytale. Shiana was already removing the grate. There are baffles, filters, and bars in the way. How will you get through?
Give me a cutter and a needle gun. I'll get the door open for you as soon as I can, from the inside.
When Aaliyah had what she needed, Duncan hoisted the girl up to where she could squirm inside the tiny tunnel. Not yet 4 years old, she weighed very little. Jessica stood watching, looking more mature than she had been only a few days earlier, but even seeing her daughter placed into such a dangerous situation, she did not protest. Cold and intent, the child clamped the cutter between her teeth, tucked the needle pistol into her small shirt, and began to creep through the vent. The distance between the chambers was not far, but each half meter was a battle. She exhaled, making herself as small as possible so that she could wriggle ahead. Outside, the others began pounding on the sealed door as a distraction. They used heavy cutters that sparked and fumed, screeching through the dense, armored barricade a millimeter at a time. The face dancer would know they'd need hours to cut through into the navigation bridge. Aaliyah was confident the face dancer would not expect an ambush from her. She encountered the first barricade, a set of plasteel bars interwoven with a filtration grid. The dense mat was coated with neutralizing chemicals and charged with a faint electrostatic film to scrub all drugs and poisons from the air that passed into the bridge. With the filter in place, Cytale's toxic gas would not have worked, even if they'd been able to release it. Elbows digging into her sides, Aaliyah took the cutter from her teeth and with jerky wrist movements sliced away the bars. Gently, she set the screen in front of her, careful not to make a noise, and crawled over it. The sharp edges scratched her chest and legs, but Aaliyah cared nothing for the pain. Similarly, she passed through a second grid, and then found herself at the last opening, from which she could observe the face dancer through the grill. His appearance flickered occasionally, sometimes reverting to the old man's shape. Sometimes becoming a futar, but primarily the face dancer wore a blank, skull-like visage. Even before she saw the torn body of Garimi on the deck, Aaliyah knew not to underestimate this opponent. With the tip of the glowing cutter, she sliced the tiny fasteners that held the last screen in place. Moving as silently as she could, she held the plate where it was and squirmed to free the needle gun from her shirt. She tensed, then drew a deep breath, waiting for the right moment.
I will have only a brief instant of surprise, so I must use it to full advantage.
The face dancer was working the controls, probably transmitting a signal to the mysterious enemy, presumably more of his own kind. Every second she delayed would place the Ithaca in greater danger. Suddenly the face dancer jerked his head up and snapped his gaze toward the grill. Somehow he had sensed her. Now, without hesitating, Aaliyah shoved the loosened screen toward him like a projectile. He dodged out of the way, reacting just as she had expected. Still lying prone in the ventilation shaft, she extended the needle gun in front of her and fired 7 times. 3 of the deadly needles found their target. 2 in the face dancer's eyes, another in the artery on his neck. He spasmed, thrashed, and fell lifeless. Wriggling out of the air shaft, Aaliyah dropped to the floor, recovered her balance, and glanced to verify that Garimi was indeed dead before casually walking to the door. With her nimble fingers, she disarmed the internal security measures and unsealed the hatch from the inside. Duncan and Teg stood there holding weapons, afraid of what might emerge. The little girl met them with a placid expression.
"Our face dancer is no longer a problem."
Over Aaliyah's shoulder, they could see the inhuman form sprawled next to an overturned chair. Small trickles of blood leaked from the dart wounds in his eyes, and he wore a full crimson collar of blood around his neck. On the floor plates lay the mangled Garimi. Shiana narrowed her gaze.
"I see that you are a born killer."
Aaliyah was unruffled.
"So I've been told. Didn't you bring the Gola children back for our abilities? This is what I do best."
Duncan hurried to the no-ship's controls to assess what the false rabbi had done. He extended his senses and was dismayed to see the deadly strands of the shimmering net suddenly appear and intensify all around them. Unbreakable. The trap was bright enough, powerful enough, that everyone could see it. Teg rushed to a scanner station.
"Duncan! Ships approaching! A lot of them! The face dancer has brought us right to the doorstep of the enemy! We're tagged, and the net has locked onto us!"
"After all these years, we are caught in the strands."
Duncan swept his gaze across all of them.
"At least, we're about to find out who our enemy really is."
Our shared humanity should, by definition, make us allies. In sad fact, however, our very similarities often appear to be vast differences and insurmountable obstacles. Mother Commander Mirbella, address to the new sisterhood. Given the critical shortage of time, the thousands of newly equipped guild ships could not undergo thorough shakedowns and test runs. The mass-produced obliterators were loaded aboard the heavily armored vessels that had been built at Junction, as well as 17 satellite shipyards. Crews made preparations to go to the front lines. Fresh from conscription across hundreds of at-risk planets, novice commanders received only minimal training, barely sufficient to stand against the enemy at numerous vulnerable points as humanity tried to draw its line in space. Mirbella knew that despite their determination and bravery, and no matter how much training and practice they received, most of the human fighters would be annihilated. In the months after the plague had run its course on Chapter House, the Mother Commander had opened her doors to displaced refugees from any evacuated planet. At first, they were frightened to settle on the once quarantined world, but then they had begun to stream in. With so few options available to them, the ragtag groups accepted the Sisterhood's offer of sanctuary in exchange for performing vital labors in the war effort. Politics and old factions had to be set aside. Now, every life was devoted to preparing for the last stand against the oncoming forces of Omnius. From Boozle, Reverend Mother Carista sent the incredible news that the giant sea worms wreaking havoc with Soustone operations also produced a kind of spice. Mirbella immediately suspected some kind of guild experiment. It could not be a natural occurrence. Carista suggested that the worms be hunted and harvested, but the Mother Commander could not think that far ahead. A new source of spice mattered only if the human race survived the enemy. Mother Commander Mirbella called a grand war council for delegates of the frontline planets that were in imminent danger of attack by thinking machine forces. Despite their indignation, every one of them had undergone cellular testing to root out hidden face dancers. Mirbella took no chances. The insidious shapeshifters could be anywhere. In the keep's grand meeting room, she strode down the length of the alaka wood table to her designated seat. Using her Bene Gesserit powers of close observation, she studied those assembled, all of them driven here by desperation. Mirbella tried to view these representatives in their various costumes and uniforms as military leaders, essentially generals in the last great battle for humanity. The people in this room would guide the thrown-together clusters of ships and make 1,000 defiant stands. But were they the quality of heroes the human race needed? When she turned to face the delegates, Mirbella saw the uneasiness in their eyes and smelled fear sweat in the air. The vast enemy fleet surged forward like a flame front across the map of the galaxy, rolling over star system after star system, heading inexorably toward Chapter House and the remaining worlds at the heart of the old empire. After moving among the various embattled worlds and studying their preparations, Mirbella had secured alliances with these planetary leaders, warlords, commercial conglomerates, and smaller units of government. Leto II's vision of the Golden Path had fragmented humanity so that they no longer followed a single charismatic leader, and now Mirbella had to repair that damage. Diversity might once have been a path to survival, but unless the numerous worlds and armies could stand together against the far greater foe, they would all perish. If the tyrant's prescience was so formidable, how could he not have foreseen the existence of the great machine empire, no matter how far away it was? How could the god emperor not have known that another titanic conflict awaited humankind? She felt a faint shudder. Or had he? And everything was playing out exactly as the tyrant planned. After considerable effort, she had won a critical internal battle when the various leaders agreed that the strongest defense came from a unified plan, her plan, rather than 100 independent and hopeless defensive battles. To get her message across, she'd had to cut through the stubborn tentacles of various planetary bureaucracies. Nothing was easy in this war. Feeling the burdens of her position, Mirbella rapped a large spherical stone on the table, producing a loud, echoing boom that called the meeting to order. You all know why you're here. We must make our last stands, 1,000 of them across space. Many of us will die, or all of us will die. There are no alternatives. The only questions are how soon we will die and how it will happen. Do we choose to die free and fighting to the last, or defeated and running? The room resounded with a cacophony of voices, accents, and languages, though she had insisted that they all speak the common Galak tongue. She used voice to cut through the clamor. The machines are coming. If we cooperate and do not retreat in the face of our foe, we just might have the means of stopping them dead in their tracks. She noted guild officials and Ixian engineers in the audience. Given the short delivery schedule, some of the warship construction had been unavoidably slapdash, but her handful of Bene Gesserit inspectors and line supervisors had overseen the operations. Our weapons and ships are now ready, but before we proceed, I have one question for all of you. She skewered the leaders with her gaze. If she'd still been an honored Matre, her eyes would have blazed orange. Do you have the resolve and courage to do what is necessary? Do you? Bellowed a bearded man from a very small planet in a remote system. Mirbella wrapped her sonic stone again. My new sisterhood will bear the brunt of the initial clash against the thinking machines. We have already fought them in one star system after another, destroying many of their ships, and we survived their plagues here on Chapter House.
but this war will never be won on individual battlefields.
She gestured, and Janess worked the controls.
Look at this, all of you.
Startling the assemblage, a large holographic projection appeared, filling the open space of the Keep's great meeting room with detailed maps of the galaxy's numerous solar systems. An advancing blot indicated the thinking machine's conquests, like a tidal wave drowning every system in its path. The darkness of defeat and extermination had already blackened most of the known systems in the regions of the scattering. We have to focus our efforts. Because they don't use fold space engines, the enemy proceeds from system to system. We know their path, and therefore we can put ourselves directly in their way. Mirbella stood amidst the simulated stars and planets. Her finger darted from point to point, the glowing stars and habitable planets that lay in the enemy's path. We've got to hold the line. Here, and here, and everywhere. Only by combining all of our ships, commanders, and weapons can we hope to halt the enemy. She swept her hand through the shimmering images that were just ahead of the encroaching thinking machines. Any other choice would be cowardice.
Do you call us cowards? The bearded man roared.
A merchant stood. Surely we can negotiate. Mirbella cut him off. The thinking machines do not want a particular world. Nor are they searching for gems, spice, or any other goods. There is nothing we can offer them to sue for peace. They do not compromise, and will keep pursuing us no matter where we run. She looked at the blustering man and said, "By fleeing conflict today, you could survive for a time. But there'll be no escape for your children or grandchildren. The machines will slaughter them down to the last infant. Do you value your life over theirs? Then yes, I do call you cowards." Despite the murmurs in the hall, no one else spoke out. On the giant star display, a line of tiny fireworks erupted along the interface line between the machine-conquered territories and the vulnerable human planets. Mirbella's gaze moved across the audience. Each of us is responsible for stopping the enemy from crossing this line. Failure means death for the human race. True loyalty is an unshakable force. The difficulty is in determining exactly where a person's allegiance lies. Often that bond is only to oneself. Duncan, Idaho, 1,000 Lives. The leader of the Face Dancer Myriad arrived at Synchrony, bearing a long-anticipated gift for the Evermind. The thinking machines still viewed Crone as nothing more than a servant, a delivery boy. Omnius and Erasmus never suspected that the shapeshifters might be formulating their own schemes, independent of both humanity and the thinking machines. Naive, oblivious, and so very typical. The Evermind would treasure this new melange for his grandiose plans, and it would keep the machines from doubting Crone and his face dancers. He intended to make the most of it. With their brutality and arrogance, the old man and woman had long ago given the new shapeshifters reasons to break their loyalty. Erasmus fancied himself reminiscent of a face dancer, but much more. And similar to a human, but greater. And like Omnius, but infinitely more powerful. Crone and the rest of the Myriad had never truly given their allegiance to the thinking machines. He saw no more reason to accept slavery under machine masters than to have accepted the domination of the original Tlilaxu, who had created their predecessors so many centuries ago. Forced allies, second-class partners. The Evermind was merely one more layer in the grand pyramid of those who thought they controlled the Face Dancers. After so much effort, Krohn couldn't wait until he could drop this endless deception. He was no longer amused by the number of masks he had to wear and the complicated threads he continued to pull. Soon, though. Alone, he flew his small ship directly to the heart of the modern machine empire. The location of Synchrony had been genetically programmed into all new Face Dancers, like some sort of homing beacon. As he entered the airspace over the technological metropolis, Krohn let his thoughts drift back to Ix. The fabricators and engineers had successfully completed a special demonstration at Dead Richesi, and now obliterators were emerging from the production lines. Mother Commander Mirbella had been impressed with the power she witnessed, and she'd been entirely convinced by the show. Fool. But not in all things. In her prior meeting with Chief Fabricator Shyama Sen, Mirbella had forced him to administer a biological test that proved he wasn't a Face Dancer. Given what had happened, Krohn was vastly relieved that he had not replaced the man, as he'd been tempted to do many times in the past. Face Dancers already controlled most of the important positions on Ix, and when the chief fabricator blithely distributed the biological tests to all the main engineers and team leaders, never suspecting there might actually be a majority of Face Dancers among them, the Myriad had been forced to act precipitously. When an indignant Sen announced the Sisterhood's suspicions, the infiltrators had finally been forced to kill him and assume his identity. They had already taken care of the troublesome Bene Gesserit line supervisors and production monitors. And so the deception continued, unmarred. Enhanced Face Dancers quickly subsumed the last humans among the leaders of Ix. Then, working together, they contrived all the necessary tests, selected the required scapegoats, substituted convincing data, and submitted everything to Chapter House in accordance with Mirbella's demands. All in perfect order. After surviving the plague, the Sisterhood's leadership had forced all human protectors to finally band together against the thinking machine fleet, to defend their race rather than simply their own worlds. The hundreds of new ships that emerged from the junction shipyards were being loaded with enough obliterators for a final concerted stand against the oncoming wave of Omnius's ships. So far, the Evermind's forces had encountered very little significant resistance, and now they were on their way to Chapter House. For the last time. Krohn had actually been tempted to let the Reverend Mothers and their last stand defenders succeed. Given enough functional obliterators, they could send the machine fleet reeling. Humans and thinking machines could easily annihilate each other. However, that was simply too easy. Kralizek demanded much more. This time, the fundamental shift in the universe would get rid of both rivals, leaving all the remnants of the old empire for the Face Dancers. Krohn felt completely confident in the future as he landed his ship in the convoluted labyrinth of copper steeples, golden turrets, and interlocked silvery buildings. Sentient structures shifted aside to allow a place for his ship to settle. When the small vessel came to rest on a smooth, quicksilver plain, Krohn stepped out, breathing air that smelled of smoke and hot metal. He did not spare a moment to look around. The central machine world was based entirely on theatrics. He suspected the touch of Erasmus in this, though Omnius had such an overblown perception of his own importance that he no doubt wanted all machine minions to bow before him as a god, even if the Evermind had to program them to do so. Rectangular plates appeared on the ground, laying down an interlocked pathway that guided Krohn to his destination in the magnificent arched cathedral. Head held high, he strode along carrying his precious package, refusing to look like a supplicant summoned before his lord. Rather, Krohn was a man on a mission with important business to complete. Omnius would be pleased to have the concentrated Ultra Spice for use with his cloned Kwisatz Haderach. Inside the ostentatious hall, the Gola of Baron Harkonnen stood with young Paolo at a 9-level pyramid chessboard. Glowering, the Baron knocked over a rook on one of the top levels. "That move is not allowed, Paolo." "It enabled me to win, didn't it?" Pleased with his ingenuity, the young man crossed his arms over his chest. "By cheating." "It's a new rule. If we are as important as you say, we should be allowed to make up our own rules." A flash of anger crossed the Baron's face and then vanished into a chuckle. "I see your reasoning, and that you are learning." When Krohn stepped forward, they looked at him with identical expressions of distaste. "Oh, it's you." The Baron sounded entirely different from when he'd been tormented by the face dancers. "I didn't think we'd be seeing you again. Bored of Caladan." Ignoring them, Krohn noted that the two principal thinking machines had resumed their guise of an elderly couple in gardening clothes. Why were they wearing these personas now? For the benefit of these two Golas? It wasn't as if the thinking machines were keeping secrets from anybody here. Krohn had never been able to determine a pattern in their behavior. Perhaps it was linked to the fact that Omnius and Erasmus wanted to receive all of the lives Krohn had gathered and assimilated during his last mission among the humans. They looked forward to the sharing of their face dancer ambassadors each time one of the far-flung representatives returned. It seemed to make them feel superior and allowed the independent robot to feel that he belonged to the human race somehow. "Look, he's brought something," Paolo pointed out. "A present for us." Krohn went directly to the old man and woman. As the woman leaned toward him, her visage had a feral and hungry look. "I think you brought more than just a package, Krohn. You haven't been back to Synchrony in some time. Show us the personas you've acquired. Every little bit adds to us, makes us greater." "I have had enough." The old man turned away. "I am beginning to find them somewhat distasteful. They are all the same."
"How can you say that, Daniel? Every human is different, so beautifully chaotic and unpredictable."
"Exactly what I mean. They are all confusing. And I am not Daniel, I am Omnius. Kralizek is upon us, and we have no time for further preparatory games."
"Sometimes I still like to consider myself Marty. In many ways, it's more appealing to me than the name or guise of Erasmus."
The old woman took a step closer to Krohn. The face dancer didn't dare flinch, though he despised what was about to happen. Her hand was gnarled, with large knuckles. It felt claw-like when she touched his forehead. She pressed harder, and Krohn shuddered, unable to block the intrusion. Each time a face dancer mimicked a human shape, He sampled the original subject and acquired both a genetic trace and an imprint of the memories and persona. The thinking machines had set the shapeshifters loose into the old empire. Infiltrating the humans, they gathered more and more lives as they subsumed useful people and played their roles. Whenever a face dancer returned to the machine empire, Erasmus in particular wanted to add those lives to his vast repository of data and experience. Out of forced subservience, Krohn and his comrades surrendered that information. But though the thinking machines could upload the various lives the face dancers copied, they could not take their core personas. Krohn held on to his secrets, even as he offered up all those people he had been in recent years. An Ixian engineer, a Chome representative, a crewman on a guild ship, a dock worker on Caladan, and many others. When the process was finished, the old woman's hand withdrew. Her wrinkled face wore a satisfied smile. Oh, those were interesting ones. Omnius will certainly want to share them. That remains to be seen, the old man said. Feeling drained, Krohn caught his breath and straightened himself. That is not why I came. His voice was shamefully weak and quavering. I have obtained a special substance you will find invaluable for your Kwisatz Haderach project. He held out the Ultra Spice package as if offering a gift to a king, precisely as Omnius expected him to behave. The old man accepted the package, scrutinized it carefully. The face dancer gave Paolo a condescending look. This potent form of melange is sure to unlock the prescience in any Atreides. Then you will have your Kwisatz Haderach, as I have always promised. There is no need to continue pursuing the no-ship. Omnius found the comment amusing. Strange you should say that now. What do you mean? Beside him, the old woman grinned. This is a momentous day, since both of our plans have come to fruition. Our patience and foresight have paid off. Now, what shall we do with two Kwisatz Haderachs? Krohn paused, startled. Two of them? After so many years, the no-ship has finally fallen into our trap. Krohn slid his surprise back into himself and went rigid. That is most excellent. The old woman rubbed her hands together. Everything is culminating at once. It reminds me of the climactic movement in a symphony I once wrote. The old man began to pace around the chamber, holding the package of Ultra Spice in his hands. He sniffed it. Paolo turned away from the chess game. You don't need another Kwisatz Haderach. You have me. Give me spice now. Erasmus shot him an indulgent smile. Perhaps in a little while. First, we'll see what the no-ship has for us. Who their Kwisatz Haderach is. It should be interesting. Where is the vessel? Krohn asked, focusing on the main question. Are you sure you have it? Our cruisers are surrounding it even now, and our operatives aboard took steps to guarantee that it could not escape again. Your face dancers did a fine job, Krohn. Omnius interrupted, and on a greater scale, our largest battleships are closing in on human defenders in their old empire. We will conquer Chapter House soon, but that is only one of many simultaneous targets. It should be quite a spectacular battle. Erasmus sounded more dry than eager. The Evermind was stern. Triumph will be assured as soon as the proper conditions are met, according to our mathematical prophecies. Success is imminent. With glee on his flow,